Fine. I doubt the need for conversation led you to this room. You didn't come here to talk about sad things that cannot be changed, Princess. I knew why I came here tonight, and Hawk was right yet again. It wasn't to talk. I came here to live, to experience, to choose, to be anyone other than who I was. None of those things included talking. But I'd had my first kiss tonight. I could stop there, or tonight could be a night of many firsts, all of my choosing. Was I really considering this? Whatever this was? Gods, I truly was. Tiny tremors rocked me. Could he feel them? They piled in my stomach, forming little knots of anticipation and fear. I was the maiden, the chosen. My earlier convictions about what the gods concerned themselves with weakened. Would they find me unworthy? Panic didn't seize me like it should. Instead, a spark of hope did. And that unsettled me more than anything. The tiny glimmer of hope felt traitorous and wholly concerning, given that being deemed unworthy resulted in one of the most serious consequences. If I were to be found unworthy, I'd face certain death. I'd be exiled from the kingdom. Chapter 3. As far as I knew, there'd only been one person who'd been found unworthy upon ascension. Their name had been erased from our histories, as well as any piece of information about who they were and whatever deeds had caused his or her exile. They'd been forbidden to live among mortals, and without family, support, or protection, faced certain death. Even the villages and farmers, with their small rises and guards, suffered staggering mortality rates. While my ascension was different from the others, I could still be found unworthy, and I imagined my punishment would be just as grave. But I didn't have the mental capacity to deal with that. No, that was a lie. I didn't want to deal with that. I should, but I wasn't leaving the room. I wasn't stopping Hawk. I'd already made up my mind, even if I didn't understand why he was still here, with me. Dampening my lower lip with my tongue, I felt dizzy and even a little faint, and I never felt faint. Those impossibly thick lashes lowered, and his gaze was so intent on my mouth that it was like a caress. I shivered. Those eyes of his seemed even brighter than before as his finger traced the outline of my mask, all the way to where the satin ribbon disappeared under the fall of my hair. May I remove this? Unable to speak, I shook my head no. Hawk halted for a moment. Then the half smile appeared. No dimple this time, though. He trailed his finger away from the mask, then ran it along the line of my jaw and down my throat to where the cloak was fastened.
How about this?
I nodded. His fingers were deft, and he brushed the cloak aside and then trailed just one fingertip along the neckline, following the rapid rise and fall of the swell of my breasts. A riot of sensations followed his finger, so many I couldn't make sense of them all.
What do you want from me?
He asked, toying with the small bow between my breasts.
Tell me, and I'll make it so.
Why? I blurted out. Why would you do this? You don't know me, and you thought I was someone else. A flicker of amusement crossed his striking features.
I have nowhere to be at the moment, and I'm intrigued.
My brows lifted. Because you have nowhere to be at the moment?
Would you rather I wax poetic about how I'm charmed by your beauty, even though I can only see half your face, which, by the way, from what I can see, is pleasing? Would you rather I tell you I'm captivated by your eyes? They are a pretty shade of green, from what I can tell.
I started to frown. Well, no, I don't want you to lie.
None of those things were a lie.
He tugged on the bow as he dipped his head, brushing his lips over mine. The soft contact sent a wave of awareness through me.
I told you the truth, princess. I'm intrigued by you. And it's fairly rare anyone intrigues me.
So? He repeated with a chuckle as his lips glided along my jaw.
You've changed my evening. I'd planned to return to my quarters, maybe get a good, albeit boring, night of sleep. But I have a suspicion that tonight will be anything but boring if I spend it with you.
I drew in a shallow breath, weirdly flattered, and yet still confused by his motivations. I wished someone was here to ask, but even if they were, that would be weird and awkward. The two glasses by the settee appeared in my mind. Were you with someone before me? His head lifted and stared down at me.
That's a random question.
There are two glasses by the settee, I pointed out.
It's also a random personal question, asked by someone whose name I don't even know.
My cheeks warmed. He had a point. He was quiet for so long that doubt crept in. Maybe I shouldn't care if he had been with someone else this evening. But I did. And if that told me anything, it screamed that this was a mistake. I was in over my head. I knew nothing about him, of what was...
I was with someone,
he answered, and disappointment swelled.
A friend, who is not like the owner of the cloak, one I hadn't seen in a while. We were catching up in private.
The dismay eased, and I decided that he must be telling the truth. He didn't have to lie to have me, when he could have any number of others who would be eager to intrigue him.
So, princess, will you tell me what you want from me?
I took another uneven breath. Anything?
Anything?
He moved his hand then, cupping my breast as he ran his thumb across the center. It was such a light touch, but I gasped as bolts of pleasure darted through me. My body reacted on its own, arching into his touch.
I'm waiting,
he said, swiping his thumb once more and scattering my already disjointed thoughts.
Tell me what you enjoy so I can make you love it.
I bit down on my lip. I don't know. Hawk's gaze flew to mine, and such a long moment passed that I began to wonder if I'd said the wrong thing.
I'll tell you what I want.
His thumb moved in slow, tight circles across a most sensitive part.
I want you to remove your mask.
A sharp, pulsing thrill rippled through my body, quickly followed by my heady wonder. What I felt. I'd never felt anything like it before. Sharp and sweet, a different type of anguish. Why?
Because I want to see you.
You can see me now.
No, princess,
he said, lowering his head until his lips brushed the neckline of my gown.
I want to really see you when I do this, without your gown between you and my mouth.
Before I could ask what he meant, I felt the wet, warm glide of his tongue through the thin silken gown. I gasped, shocked by the act and by the rush of liquid heat it brought forth. But then his gaze lifted to mine as his mouth closed over the tip of my breast. He sucked. Deep and long, and the gasp turned to a cry that would surely embarrass me later.
Remove your mask.
His head lifted as he slid a hand over my hip.
Please?
He wouldn't recognize me if I did. Hawk would never know who I was, with or without the mask, but if I removed the facial covering, would he say what the Duke often did? That I was both a masterpiece and a tragedy? And when he felt the uneven slices of skin scattering along my stomach and thighs, would he jerk his hand away in horror? My skin chilled.
I hadn't thought this through. At all. The wonderful, exhilarating heat dimmed. Hawk wasn't an ascended, but he was like them in appearance, nearly flawless. I hadn't ever been ashamed of the scars before, not when they were proof of the horror I'd survived. But if he... Hawk's hand slid down the outer right thigh to where the dress parted and stopped, right over the hilt of the dagger.
What the?
Before I could even take another breath, he'd unsheathed the blade, his fingers coming precariously close to one of the scars. I sat up, but he was faster, rocking backward. The candlelight glinted off the red blade.
Bloodstone and woven bone.
Give that back, I demanded, scrambling to my knees. His gaze shifted from the dagger to me.
This is a unique weapon.
I know. My hair fell forward over my shoulders.
The kind that's not inexpensive, he continued. Why are you in possession of this, princess?
It was a gift, which was true, and I'm not foolish enough to come to a place like this unarmed. He stared at me for a moment, then focused on the dagger again.
Carrying a weapon and having no idea how to use it does not make one wise.
Irritation flared to life, just as hotly as the desire he'd elicited from me mere moments ago. What makes you think I don't know how to use it? Because I'm female?
You can't be surprised that I would be shocked. Learning how to use a dagger isn't exactly common for females in Solis.
You're right. And he was. It wasn't socially appropriate for females to know how to wield a weapon or be able to defend themselves, something that always bothered me. If my mother had known how to defend herself, she might still be here. But I do know how to use it. The right side of his lips curved up.
Now I'm truly intrigued.
He moved unbelievably fast, thrusting the dagger blade down into the bed. I gasped, wondering what the owners of the Red Pearl would think of that. But then he pounced. He took me back down to the mattress, his weight covering me once more, and he pressed into me in a way that caused all the interesting parts to meet. His mouth lined up with mine. A fist pounded on the door, silencing whatever he was about to ask.
Hawk!
A male voice rang out.
You in there?
He stiffened above me, his warm breath against my lips as he closed his eyes.
It's Kieran!
The man called out a name I didn't recognize.
As if I didn't know that already.
Hawk muttered under his breath, and a small giggle left me. His eyes opened and a half-grin appeared.
Hawk!
Kieran pounded some more. I think you should answer him, I whispered.
Damn it,
he cursed. Looking over his shoulder, he called out,
I'm thoroughly happily busy at the moment. Sorry to hear that,
Kieran replied as Hawk refocused on me. Kieran knocked again.
But the interruption is unavoidable. The only unavoidable thing I see is your soon-to-be broken hand if you pound on that door one more time,
Hawk warned, and my eyes widened.
What, princess?
His voice lowered.
I told you I was really intrigued. Then I must risk a broken hand,
Kieran answered. A growl of frustration rumbled from deep within Hawk's throat, the sound strangely animalistic. Goosebumps pimpled my skin.
The envoy has arrived,
Kieran added through the door. Shadows crept across Hawk's face. His lips moved as if he murmured something, but the sound was too low for me to hear. A chill chased away some of the heat. An envoy? He nodded.
The supplies we've been waiting for, he explained. I need to go.
I nodded in return, understanding that he had to leave, as I reached between us, grasping the edge of the cloak. For a long moment, Hawk didn't move, but then he shifted off me, standing. He called out to Kieran as he grabbed his tunic off the floor. I yanked the forgotten dagger out of the mattress, quickly sheathing it as he pulled the tunic over his head and shrugged a baldric over his shoulders, securing the belt at his waist. There were two sheaths at his sides for weapons, weapons I hadn't been aware of until now. He picked up two short swords from the chest near the door, and I thought that maybe I needed to be better aware of my surroundings the next time I barged into a room. His blades were honed to a wicked, deadly point, intended for close contact fighting, and each side was serrated, designed to cut through flesh and muscle. I knew how to use them too, but I kept that to myself.
I'll come back as soon as I can.
He sheathed the swords flat to his sides.
I swear.
I nodded once more. Hawk stared at me.
Tell me that you'll wait for me, princess.
My heart skipped over itself.
I will.
Turning, he walked to the door and then stopped. He faced me.
I look forward to returning.
I said nothing as he left the room, opening the door only wide enough for him to slip through. When the door clicked into place behind him, I let go of the breath I'd been holding and looked down at the front of my gown. The area of my breast was still damp, the white material nearly transparent. My cheeks flushed hotly as I scooted off the bed and stood on surprisingly weak knees. My gaze lifted to the door, and I closed my eyes, unsure if I was disappointed or relieved by the interruption. Truthfully, it was a mixture of both, because I'd lied to Hawk. I wouldn't be here when he returned.
What did you do last night?
The question snapped my attention from the biscuit I was currently devouring to the lady in wait who sat across from me. Tawny Lion was the second daughter of a successful merchant, given to the royal court at the age of 13 during the rite. Tall and lithe, with rich brown skin and beautiful brown eyes, she was absolutely enviable. Some of the ladies and lords in wait were assigned tasks outside of preparation to join the court after ascension. And since we were the same age, she had been assigned as my companion shortly after her rite. Her duty ranged from keeping me company to assisting me with my bath or to dress if I required it. Tawny was one of the few people who could make me laugh over the silliest things. Actually, she was one of the few people who were even allowed to speak to me. She was the closest thing I had to a friend, and I cared for her deeply. I believed she cared for me too, or at the very least, liked me. But she was required to be with me unless I dismissed her for the day. If she hadn't been given the task of being my companion, we never would have spoken. That fact was not a reflection upon her as a person, but because she would be like all the rest, either forbidden to socialize with me or wary of my presence. The knowledge often sat heavy in my chest, another chunk of ice. But even though I knew our friendship was rooted in duty, I trusted her, at least to a certain degree. She knew I was trained, but she didn't know the things I sometimes assisted Victor with, and she had no knowledge of my gifts. I kept those things to myself because sharing that information would either put others or her in harm's way.
I was here.
Wiping buttery crumbs from my fingers, I gestured to the rather sparse chamber. We were in the small anteroom that opened up to the bedroom. There were only two chairs by the fireplace, a wardrobe and a chest, a bed, one nightstand, and a heavy fur rug under our feet. Others had more creature comforts. Tawny had a beautiful chaise in her room and a pile of plush floor coverings. And I knew some of the other ladies and lords in wait had vanities or desks. Walls lined with bookshelves, and even electricity. Over the years, those items had been stripped from my chamber for one infraction or another.
You were not in your room, Tawny said.
A simple topknot was trying, and failing, to keep the mass of brown and gold curls swept back from her face. More than a few had snuck free to rest against her cheeks.
I checked on you shortly after midnight, and you weren't here.
My heart skipped a beat. Had something occurred where the Duke or Duchess had sent Tawny for me? If so, Tawny wouldn't be able to lie. But I imagined if that had happened, I would already know.
I would already have been summoned to the Duke's private office. Why were you checking on me? I asked. I thought I heard your door opening and closing, so I decided to investigate, but no one was here. She paused. No one, including you. There was no way she'd heard me return. I'd used the old servant's access, and while that door was as creaky as a bag of bones, her room was on the other side of where my bed sat. That door was one of the reasons I'd never asked to be moved to the newer renovated parts of the stronghold. Through there, I could access nearly any part of the castle and could come and go without being seen. It more than compensated for the lack of electricity and the constant chilly draft that seemed to always make its way around the windows, no matter how sunny the day was. My palms dampened as I glanced at the closed hallway door. Had someone been looking for me? Again, I would know by now. So it was likely Tawny thought she heard something. Knowing Tawny as I did, I knew she wouldn't let this go if I didn't give her something. I couldn't sleep last night. Nightmares? I nodded, feeling a little guilty for the sympathy that crept into her eyes. You've been having a lot of them lately. She leaned back in the chair. Are you sure you don't want to try one of the sleeping draughts the healer made for you? Yes, I don't like the idea of being knocked out senseless. She finished for me. It's really not that bad, Poppy. You rest very deeply, and honestly, with as little sleep as you manage, I think it would be good to at least try. The mere idea of taking something that would put me in such a deep sleep that it would take an army marching through my bedchamber to wake me made me sweat. I would be rendered completely helpless, and that was something I would never allow to happen. So, what did you do? A pause. Or should I ask, where did you go? Her eyes narrowed as I became enraptured in the fine trim of the napkin. You snuck out, didn't you? In that moment, Tawny proved that she knew me just as well as I knew her. I don't know why you'd think that. Because you have a history of doing that. She laughed when I glanced up at her. Come on, tell me what you did. I'm sure it's more exciting than what I was doing, which was listening to Mistress Cambria prattle on about how inappropriate this lady or lord-in-wait is. I bled a viciously upset stomach just to be able to excuse myself. I giggled, knowing that Tawny would have done just that. The mistresses are a lot to handle. That's being too kind, she remarked. Grinning, I picked up the cup of creamed coffee. The mistresses were servants of the Duchess, who helped her run the household, but also kept track of the ladies in wait. Mistress Cambria was a dragon of a woman that scared even me. I did sneak out, I admitted. Where did you go without me? I think you might be upset when you hear where. Most likely. I peeked up at her. The Red Pearl? Her eyes widened to the size of the saucers scattered across the trolley between us. Are you serious? I nodded. I can't. She appeared to take a deep breath. How? I borrowed one of the maid's cloaks, and I used that mask I found. You devious little thief. I returned the cloak this morning, so I don't think you can call me a thief. Who cares if you returned it? She tipped forward. What was it like? Interesting, I said. And when she begged for more details, I told her what I'd seen. She was enthralled, hanging on every word I said, as if I were sharing with her the actual ritual that completed the ascension. I can't believe you didn't take me with you. She fell back in her chair with a pout, but then sprang forward once more. Did you see anyone there you recognized? Lauren claims she goes there nearly every other evening. Lauren, another lady in wait, claimed many things. I didn't see her, but I trailed off, unsure if I should tell her about Hawk. I'd left no more than 10 minutes after Hawk had, relieved to find that Victor was also nowhere to be seen. Neither was the strange woman who knew more than she should. I'd done everything in my power not to think about what had happened in that room with him, which meant I failed the moment I returned to my bed. I'd lain there until exhaustion claimed me, replaying everything he'd said, everything he'd done. I'd woken with the strangest frustration, an ache in my chest and lower belly. "But what?" she asked. I wanted to tell her. Gods, did I ever want to share what had happened with Hawk with someone? I had 100 questions bursting to be let out, but last night was different. I'd crossed a big line, and while I didn't feel like I had debased myself or done anything truly wrong, I knew that my guardians wouldn't agree. Neither would the priests and priestesses. Going to the Red Pearl was one thing. Sharing myself in any form with another was a totally different matter. That knowledge could be a weapon. I trusted Tawny, but as I acknowledged before, only to a certain degree. And even though the mere thought of Hawk made my stomach tighten into dozens of little coils, it wasn't something that would ever happen again. When I saw him during the city council sessions, he wouldn't know that it had been me he'd called princess. He'd have no idea that he'd been my first kiss. What we'd done, it belonged to just me. It had to stay that way. I exhaled slowly, ignoring the sudden scratchy lump in my throat. But many were wearing masks. She could have been there, and I wouldn't have known. Anyone could have been. If you ever go to the Red Pearl without me again, I will cut holes in the bottoms of your shoes, she warned, toying with the white beads dotting the neckline of her rose-colored gown. A shocked laugh left me. Wow, she giggled. Honestly, I'm glad you didn't go with me. When she frowned, I quickly added, I really shouldn't have gone there myself. Yes, going to the Red Pearl is forbidden, and I'm sure it's as forbidden as you being trained to use a dagger or a sword as a guard on the rise. That was something I hadn't been able to hide from Tawny, and she had never shared, which was one of the reasons I knew I could trust her with most things. Yes, but just like that one time you snuck out to view a fighting ring, or when you convinced me to bathe in the lake, that was your idea. I corrected, and her willingness to aid me in doing forbidden things was the other reason she held almost all of my trust. And it was also your idea to do it without clothing. Who bathes in their clothes? She asked, widening her eyes innocently. And that was a mutual idea, thank you very much. I think we should do that again, and soon, before it gets too cold to even walk outside. But I could spend all morning listing things that you've done that are either forbidden by the Duke and Duchess or prohibited for the maiden to do. And up until now, nothing has happened. The gods haven't appeared and deemed you unworthy. That's true, I acknowledged, as I smoothed a crease from the skirt of my gown. Of course it is. She plucked up a small, round, powdery pastry and popped it into her mouth. Somehow, she didn't get a single dusting of sugar on her. Meanwhile, if I so much as breathed in the direction of those pastries, I ended up with a fine coating of white powder in places that made no sense. So, when do we go back? I don't think I should. You don't want to? I opened my mouth, then closed it, and tried not to fall down that rabbit hole. The problem was that I wanted to go back. When I was lying in bed and hadn't been obsessively rewinding the time spent with Hawk, reliving the razor-edged yearning and thrill his kiss had dragged out of me, I'd wondered if he had come back like he promised, and if I had done the right thing by leaving. Of course, in the eyes of my guardians and the gods, it had been the right thing. But had it been so for me? Should I have stayed and experienced infinitely more before there might not be any more chances? My gaze lifted to the windows that faced the west portion of the rise. The dark shapes of the guards patrolling the ledge were the only movement. Was Hawk out there? Why was I even wondering that? Because there was more than just a small part of me that wished I'd stayed, and I knew it would be a long time before I stopped wondering about what would have happened if I'd waited. Would he have carried out whatever I'd wanted? I didn't even know what that would have entailed. I had ideas. I had my imagination. I had other people's stories of their experiences, but they were not mine. They were just thin, transparent copies of the real thing. And I knew if I returned, I would go back in hopes that he'd be there. That was why I shouldn't go back. Looking at the open wardrobe, I first saw the white veil with its delicate gold chains, and a heaviness settled over me. I could already feel its substantial weight, even though the material was made out of the finest, lightest silk. When it first slipped over my head at age 8, I'd panicked, but after 10 years, I should have grown used to it by now. While I no longer felt like I couldn't breathe or see while wearing it, it still felt heavy. Hanging beside it was the only color in my wardrobe, a splash of red among a sea of white. It was a ceremonial gown tailored for the upcoming rite. The dress had arrived the morning before, and I hadn't tried it on yet. It would be the first time I was allowed to attend, allowed to wear anything other than white, and be seen without the veil. Of course, I would be masked, like everyone else. The only reason I was allowed to attend this rite when all the others had been forbidden was because it would be the last rite before my ascension. Whatever excitement I felt about the rite was tempered by the fact that it would be the last. Tawny rose and drifted to one of the windows. "The mist hasn't come in a while." Tawny had a habit of jumping from topic to topic, but this switch was jarring. "What made you think of that?"
"I don't know." She tucked back a loose curl. "Actually, I do. I overheard Daphina and Lauren talking last night," she said. "They claimed they heard from one of the huntsmen that the mist has been gathering beyond the Blood Forest."
"I hadn't heard that." My stomach knotted as I remembered Finley, and I wished I hadn't eaten so many slices of bacon.
"I probably shouldn't have brought it up."
She turned from the window.
"It's just that it has been decades since the mist even neared the capital. It's not something we have to worry about there."
No matter where we were, the mist was something to worry about. Just because it hadn't gotten close in decades didn't mean it wouldn't. But I didn't say that. She pushed away from the window, coming back to the table to kneel next to where I sat.
"Can I be honest with you for a moment?"
My brows rose. "Aren't you always?"
"Well, yes. But this is different."
More than curious to know what she was thinking about, I nodded for her to go on. Tawny drew in a deep breath.
"I know our lives are different, as were our pasts, and as our futures will be. But you treat the ascension as if it may very well be your death, when it is the exact opposite. It's life. It's a new beginning. It is a blessing."
"You're starting to sound like the Duchess," I teased.
"But it's the truth."
She reached over and clasped my hand.
"In a few months, you won't be dead, Poppy. You'll be alive and no longer bound by these rules. You'll be in the capital."
"I'll have been given to the gods," I corrected her.
"And how amazing is that? You will experience something very few people do. I know you fear that you won't return from them, but you're the queen's favorite maiden."
"I'm her only maiden."
Her eyes rolled. "You know that's not why."
I did. The queen had done more for me than was ever required of her, but that didn't change that my ascension would be nothing like hers.
"And when you come back ascended, I will be right by your side. Just think of the mischief we can make."
Tawny squeezed my hand, and I saw that she truly believed that would happen. It could, but it wasn't a certainty. I had no idea what it truly meant to be given to the gods. Although every small detail seemed to be documented about the history of the kingdom, there were a few things that weren't written about. I'd never been able to find anything about previous maidens, and I'd asked Priestess Analia over 100 times what it meant to be given to the gods, and the answer was always the same. A maiden doesn't question the gods' plans. She has faith in them without knowledge of them. Maybe I truly wasn't worthy of being a maiden, because I found it hard to have faith in anything without knowledge of it. But Tawny did, as did Victor and Rylan, and literally everyone else I knew, even Ian. None of them had been given to the gods, though. I searched Tawny's eyes, looking for just the slightest hint of fear. You're not afraid at all, are you? Of the Ascension? She rose, locking her fingers together in front of her. Nervous, yes. Afraid? No, I'm excited to begin a new chapter, to begin a life that was her own, where she could wake up and eat whenever she pleased, spend her days however she wanted, and with whomever she desired, instead of being my perpetual shadow. Of course she wasn't afraid. And while I didn't feel the same, I had not once taken into consideration what it meant for her. For the most part, Tawny was always more than willing to take part in whatever adventure I conjured up, and even suggested some herself. But if the gods were watching, especially this close to the Ascension, they could find her unworthy for taking part. That wasn't something I'd just now thought about. But it hadn't struck me with such clarity before that my attitude toward the Ascension could ruin her eagerness. Guilt surfaced, the taste of it sour in the back of my throat. I'm so selfish. Tawny blinked, bewildered. What makes you say that? I've most likely tarnished your excitement with all my doom and gloom, I told her. I haven't really thought about how excited you must be. Well, when you put it that way, she said, and then laughed, the sound soft and warm. Honestly, Poppy, you haven't. How you feel about the Ascension hasn't affected how I feel. I'm relieved to hear that. But still, I should be more excited for you. That's what, I took a thin breath. That's what friends do. Have you been excited for me? Happy? She asked. Even though you're worried for yourself? I nodded. Of course. Then you have done what a friend does. Maybe that was true. But I promised myself I would be better, starting with no longer risking her ascension by involving her in my escapades. I could live with the dire consequences of being found unworthy because it would be my life and my own actions that led to it. But I wouldn't do that to Tawny. I couldn't live with that. After I took supper in my room later that day, Victor knocked on my door. When I looked up at his face, golden and weathered by life on the rise and years in the sun, I didn't think about knowing where he was the night before and the subsequent awkwardness. I saw his expression and knew something had occurred. What's happened? I whispered. We've been summoned, he said, and my heart lurched in my chest. There were only 2 reasons why we'd be summoned. One would be the Duke, and the other was equally terrible, but for far different reasons. There's a cursed. Chapter 4. Without wasting one unnecessary second, we left my room and the castle through the old servants' access. Then we moved like ghosts through the city until we found ourselves standing before an old, battered door. The white handkerchief tacked just below the handle was the only reason the home in the lower ward of Macedonia was distinguishable from the other squat, narrow houses stacked on top of one another. glancing over his shoulder to where two city guards chatted under the yellow glow of a street lamp. Victor quickly pulled the handkerchief off the door and slipped it into a pocket inside his dark cloak. The small white cloth was a symbol of the network of people who believed death, no matter how violent or destructive, deserved dignity. It was also evidence of high treason and disloyalty to the crown. I had accidentally discovered what Victor took part in when I was 15. He'd left one of our training sessions in a hurry one morning, and sensing that something was going on, based on the mental pain the messenger had been throwing off, I'd followed. Obviously, Victor hadn't been pleased. What he was doing was considered treasonous, and being caught wasn't the only danger. However, I'd always been disturbed by how these things were typically handled. I demanded he allow me to help. He had said no, repeated it probably 100 times. But I had been relentless, and besides, I was uniquely suited to assist in such matters. Victor knew what I could do, and his empathy for others had aided my desire to help. We'd been doing this for about 3 years now. We weren't the only ones. There were others. Some were guards, a few were citizens. I never met any. For all I knew, Hawk could be one. My stomach dipped and then rolled before I shoved any thoughts of Hawk out of my mind. Victor quietly rapped his knuckles on the door and then returned his gloved hand to the hilt of his broadsword. A couple of seconds later, hinges creaked as the old battered door shuddered open, revealing the pale round face and red puffy eyes of a woman. She might have been in her mid to late 20s, but the tense pinch to her brow and the lines bracketing her mouth made her appear decades older. The cause of her worn appearance had everything to do with the kind of pain that cut deeper than the physical and was caused by the smell wafting out of the building from behind her. Under the thick, cloying smoke of earthy incense was the unmistakable sour and sickeningly sweet scent of rot and decay, of a curse.
You're in need of aid?
Victor spoke low. The woman fiddled with the button on her wrinkled blouse, her weary gaze darting from Victor to me. I opened my senses to her. Soul-deep pain radiated from her in waves I couldn't see, but it was so heavy. It was almost a tangible entity surrounding her. I could feel it slicing through my cloak and clothing and scraping against my skin like rusty, icy nails. She felt like someone who was dying but hadn't suffered a single injury or disease. That was how raw and potent her pain was. Fighting the urge to take a step back, I shuddered inside my heavy cloak. Every instinct in me demanded that I put distance between us, get as far away as possible. Her grief formed iron shackles around my ankles, weighing me down as it tightened around my neck. Emotion clogged my throat, tasting like bitter desperation and sour hopelessness. I pulled back my senses, but I had opened myself up for too long. I was tuned into her anguish now. "Who's that?" she rasped. Her voice was hoarse with the tears I knew had swelled her eyes.
"Someone who can help you."
Victor answered in a way I was all too familiar with. He used that calm tone whenever I was seconds away from acting out in anger and doing something entirely reckless, which, according to Victor, was way too often.
"Please, allow us to enter."
Fingers stilling around the button below her throat, she gave a curt nod and then stepped back. I followed Victor inside, scanning the dimly lit room, which turned out to be a combined kitchen and living space. There was no electricity in the home, only oil lamps and fat, waxy candles. That wasn't exactly surprising to see. Even though electricity had been provided to the area of the lower ward to light the streets and some of the businesses, only the wealthy had it inside their homes, and they would not be found in the lower ward. They'd be closer to the center of Macedonia, near Castle Tirman, and as far from the rise as possible. But here, the rise loomed. Drawing in a shallow breath, I tried not to focus on how the woman's grief painted the walls and floors an oily black. Her pain had gathered here, among the knickknacks and clay plates, quilted blankets with frayed edges, and tired furniture. Clasping my hands together under the cloak, I took another breath, this one deeper, and looked around. A lantern sat on a wooden table next to several sticks of burning incense. Surrounding the brick hearth were several chairs. I zeroed in on the closed door on the other side of the fireplace, my hooded head tilted as I squinted. On the mantel, closest to the door, was a narrow spike of a blade the color of burgundy in the low light. Bloodstone. This woman had been prepared to handle this herself, and with the way she felt, that would be disastrous. "What is your name?" Victor asked, as he reached up to lower the hood of his cloak. He always did this, showed his face to comfort family or friends, to put them at ease. A lock of blonde hair fell across his forehead as he turned to the woman. I did not reveal myself.
Agnes, she answered, her throat working on a swallow. I heard about the white handkerchief, but I wasn't sure if anyone would come. I wondered if it was some kind of myth or a trick.
It's no trick.
Victor may be one of the deadliest guards in the entire city, if not the kingdom. But I knew when Agnes looked up into his blue eyes, all she saw was kindness. Who is ill? Agnes swallowed once more, the skin around her eyes puckering as she briefly squeezed them shut.
My husband, Marlowe. He's a huntsman for the rise, and he returned home 2 days ago.
Her breath caught, and she exhaled heavily.
He'd been gone for months. I was so happy to see him. I'd missed him terribly, and with each day, I feared he'd perished on the road. But he came back.
My heart squeezed as if it had been caught in a fist. I thought of Finley. Had he been a huntsman? A part of this group that involved Marlowe?
He seemed a little under the weather at first, but that's not uncommon. His work is exhausting, she continued. But he started to show signs that night.
That night?
Only a small note of alarm had crept into Victor's tone, and my eyes widened with a whole cartload more dismay.
And you waited until now?
We hoped it was something else. A cold. Or the flu.
Her hand fluttered back to the buttons. Threads were beginning to show along the wooden discs.
I didn't know until last night that it was something more. He didn't want me to know. Marlowe is a good man, you understand? He wasn't trying to hide it. He planned to take care of himself, but...
But the curse would not allow it.
Victor finished for her, and she nodded. I glanced back at the door. The curse progressed differently for everyone. It took hold for some in a matter of hours, while for others it could take a day or two. But I knew of no cases that went beyond 3. It had to be only a matter of time before he succumbed, possibly hours or minutes.
It's okay,
Victor assured her, but it truly wasn't.
Where is he now?
Pressing her other hand to her mouth, she jerked her chin toward the closed door. The sleeve of her blouse was stained with some dark substance.
It's still him.
Her words were a little muffled.
He's still in there. That's how he wants to go to the gods, as himself.
Is there anyone else here?
She shook her head, letting out another ragged breath. Have you said your goodbyes? I asked. The woman jerked around at the sound of my voice, her eyes widening. My cloak was rather shapeless, so I imagined she was surprised to hear that I was female. A female would be the last thing anyone would expect in situations like these.
"It's you," she whispered.
I stilled. Victor didn't. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw his hand return to the hilt of the sword. Agnes moved suddenly, and Victor went to unsheathe his weapon, but before he or I could react, she collapsed to her knees before me. Bowing her head, she folded her hands under her chin. My eyes widened under the hood as I slowly looked at Victor. He arched a brow.
"They spoke of you," she whispered, rocking in short, jerky movements.
My heart might have stopped.
"They say you're the child of the gods."
I blinked once and then twice as tiny goosebumps pimpled my skin. My parents were flesh and blood. I was definitely not a child of the gods, but I knew many people of Solus saw the maiden as such.
"Who has said this?"
Victor asked, shooting me a look that said this was something we'd be talking about later. Agnes lifted tear-stained cheeks, shaking her head.
"I don't want to get anyone in trouble, please. They didn't speak to spread rumors or ill will. It's just that..."
She trailed off, her gaze drifting toward me. Her voice dropped to barely a whisper.
"They say you have the gift."
Someone had definitely been talking. A subtle shiver curled its way down my spine, but I ignored it as the woman's pain pulsed and flared. "I'm no one of importance," Victor inhaled noisily. "Agnes, please." Under the cloak, I tugged off my gloves, placing them into a pocket. I slipped my hand through the opening of the heavy folds, offering it to her, as I stole a quick glance at Victor. His eyes narrowed on me.
"I was so gonna hear about this later, but whatever lecture I was bound to receive would be worth it."
Agnes's gaze dropped to my hand, and then, slowly, she lifted her arm and placed her palm against mine. As she rose, I curled my fingers around her cool hand, and I thought of the golden, sparkling sand surrounding the Stroud Sea, of warmth and laughter. I saw my parents, their features no longer clear but lost to time, fuzzy and undefined. I felt the warm, damp breeze in my hair, the sand under my feet. It was the last happy memory I had of my parents. Agnes's arm trembled as she took a sudden heavy breath.
"What?"
She trailed off, her mouth going lax as her shoulders lowered. The suffocating anguish retracted, collapsing into itself like a matchstick house in a windstorm. Her dampened lashes blinked rapidly, and rosy color infused her cheeks. I let go of her hand the moment the room felt more open and light, fresher. There was still a sharp edge of pain lingering in the shadows, but it was now manageable for her. For me. Agnes placed a hand to her breast, giving a little shake of her head. Her brow pinched as she stared at her right hand. Almost tentatively, she returned her gaze to me.
"I feel like I can breathe again."
Understanding crept across her face, quickly followed by the gleam of awe in her eyes.
"The gift."
I slipped my hand back under my cloak, conscious of the ball of tension brewing inside me. Agnes trembled. For a moment, I was afraid she would drop to the floor again, but she didn't.
"Thank you. Thank you so much. My gods, thank—"
"There is nothing you need to thank me for," I cut her off. "Have you said your goodbyes?" I asked once more. Time was getting away from us. Time we didn't have. Tears glimmered as she nodded, but the grief didn't cease as it did before. What I'd done wouldn't last. The pain would resurface. Hopefully by then she would be able to process it. If not, the grief would always linger, a ghost that would haunt every happy moment in her life until it became all she knew.
We will see him now,
Victor announced. It would be best if you remained out here. Closing her eyes, Agnes nodded. Victor touched my arm as he turned, and I followed. My gaze landed on the settee closest to the hearth as Victor reached the door. A floppy-headed stuffed doll with yellow hair made of yarn lay partially hidden behind the thin cushion. Tiny goosebumps broke out across my skin as unease balled in the pit of my stomach.
Will you? Agnes called out. Will you ease his passing?
Of course, I said, turning back to Victor. I placed a hand on his back and waited for him to dip his head. I kept my voice low as I said,
There is a child here.
Victor halted with his hand on the door, and I tilted my head toward the settee. His gaze followed. I couldn't sense people, only their pain once I saw them. If a child was here, he or she must be hidden away and possibly completely unaware of what was happening. But then, why hadn't Agnes admitted to the child being here? The unease expanded, and the worst-case scenario played out in my mind. I will handle this. You handle that. Victor hesitated, his blue eyes wary as they lifted to the door. I can take care of myself. I reminded him of what he already knew. The fact that I could defend myself rested solely on his shoulders. A heavy sigh rattled from him as he muttered,
That doesn't mean you always have to.
He stepped back, though, facing Agnes.
Would it be too much trouble to ask for something warm to drink?
Oh, no, of course not, Agnes answered. I could make up some tea or coffee.
Do you, perhaps, have hot cocoa?
Victor asked, and I smirked. While that was something a parent may have on hand and could be seen as him searching for additional evidence of a child, it was also Victor's greatest weakness.
I do.
Agnes cleared her throat, and I heard the sound of a cupboard opening. Victor nodded at me. And I stepped forward, placing my hand on the door and pushing it open. If I hadn't been prepared for the too sweet and the bitter-sour stench, it would have knocked me over. My gag reflex threatened to be triggered as my gaze adapted to the candlelit bedroom. I would just have to not breathe as often. Sounded like a solid plan. I swept the room with a quick glance. Except for the bed, a tall wardrobe, and two rickety-looking end tables, the room was bare. More incense burned in here, but it couldn't beat back the smell. My attention returned to the bed, to the form lying impossibly still in the center of it. Stepping inside, I closed the door behind me and started forward, slipping my right hand back into the cloak, to my right thigh. My fingers curled over the always cold hilt of my dagger as I focused on the man, or what was left of him. He was young, that much I could tell, with light brown hair and broad shoulders that trembled. His skin had taken on a gray pallor, and his cheeks were sunken as if his stomach hadn't been full in weeks. Dark shadows blossomed under eyelids that spasmed every couple of seconds. The color of his lips was more blue than pink. Taking a deep breath, I opened myself up once more. He was in great pain, both physical and emotional. It wasn't the same as Agnes's, but no less potent or heavy. In here, the anguish left no room for light, and it went beyond suffocating. It choked and clawed in the knowledge that there was no way out of this. A tremor coursed through me as I forced myself to sit beside him. Unsheathing the dagger, I kept it hidden under my cloak as I lifted my left hand and carefully pulled the sheet down. His chest was bare, and the shivers increased as the cooler air of the room reached his waxy skin. My gaze traveled down the length of his concave stomach. I saw the wound he'd hidden from his wife. It was above his right hip. 4 ragged tears in his skin, 2 side by side, an inch or so above 2 identical wounds. He'd been bitten. One who didn't know better would think some sort of wild animal had gotten a hold of him. But this wasn't the wound of an animal. It seeped blood and something darker, oilier. Faint, reddish-blue lines radiated out from the bite, spreading across his lower stomach and disappearing under the sheet. A ravaged moan drew my gaze upward. His lips peeled back, revealing just how close he was to a fate worse than death. His gums bled, streaking his teeth. Teeth that were already changing. 2 on top, 2 on the bottom. His canines had already elongated. I looked to where his hand rested next to my leg. His nails had also lengthened, becoming more animalistic than mortal. Within an hour, both his teeth and nails would harden and sharpen. They'd be able to cut and chew through skin and muscle. He would become one of them. A craven. Driven by an insatiable hunger for blood, he would slaughter everyone in sight. And if anyone were to survive his attack, they would eventually become just like him. Well, not everyone. I hadn't. But he was becoming what existed outside the rise, what lived inside the thick, unnatural mist. The foulness that the fallen kingdom of Atlantia had cursed these lands with. Some 400 years after the War of Two Kings had ended, they were still a plague. The Kraven were creations of the Atlanteans, the product of their poisonous kiss, which acted like an infection, turning innocent men, women, and children into starved creatures whose body and mind became twisted and decayed by ceaseless hunger. Even though the majority of Atlanteans had been hunted into extinction, many still existed, and there only needed to be 1 Atlantean alive for there to be 12 Kraven. If not more. They weren't completely mindless. They could be controlled, but only by the Dark One. And this poor man had fought back and escaped, but he must have known what the bite meant. From birth, we all knew. It was part of the kingdom's blood-soaked history. He was cursed, and there was nothing that could be done. Had he come back to say goodbye to his wife? To a child? Had he thought he would be different, blessed by the gods? Chosen? It didn't matter. Sighing, I replaced the sheet, leaving his upper chest bare. Trying not to breathe too deeply, I set my palm on his skin. His flesh, it felt all wrong, like cold leather. I concentrated on the beaches of Carcedonia, the capital, and the dazzling blue waters of the Stroud. I remembered the clouds, how fat and fluffy they were, how they looked like peace must feel. And I thought of the Queen's gardens outside of Castle Tearman, where I could simply be and not think or feel anything, where everything, including my own mind, was quiet. I thought of the warmth those 2 brief moments with Hawk had brought forth. Marlowe's shivers subsided, and the twitching behind his eyes slowed. The puckered skin at the corners of his eyes smoothed out. Marlowe, I said, ignoring the dull pain that started to blossom behind my eyes. A headache would eventually come. One always did when I repeatedly opened myself or used my gift. The chest under my hand rose deeply, and clumped lashes fluttered. His eyes opened, and I tensed. They were blue, mostly. Bolts of red shot through the irises. Soon there would be no blue left, only the color of blood. His dry lips parted.
Are you Rain? Have you come to take me at my end?
He thought I was the god of the common man and endings, a god of death. No, I'm not. Knowing that his pain would be eased long enough for this to be completed, I lifted my left hand and did the one thing I was expressly forbidden to do, not just by the Duke and Duchess of Macedonia or by the Queen, but also by the gods. I did what Hawk had asked in regards to the mask, but I'd refused. I pulled down my hood and then removed the white domino mask I wore just in case my cloak slipped, revealing my face. I figured, or hoped, that the gods would make an exception in cases like this. His crimson-laced gaze drifted over my features, starting where wisps of burnt copper hair curled against my forehead, then the right side of my face, followed by my left. His stare lingered there, over the evidence of what a craven's claws could do. I wondered if he thought the same thing the Duke always did. Such a shame. Those three words seemed to be the Duke's favorite. That and, "You have disappointed me."
"Who are you?"
he rasped out. "My name is Penelope, but my brother and a few others call me Poppy."
"Poppy,"
he whispered. I nodded. "It's a strange nickname, but my mother used to call me that. It sort of stuck." Marlowe blinked slowly.
"Why are—"
The corners of his mouth cracked, the new wounds seeping blood and darkness.
"Why are you here?"
Forcing a smile, I tightened my grip on the hilt of the dagger and did another thing that should end with me being hauled to the temple, but hadn't yet, because this wasn't the first time I'd revealed myself to the dying. "I am the maiden." His chest rose with a sharp inhale, and he closed his eyes. A tremor coursed through him.
"You're the chosen, born in the shroud of the gods, protected even inside the womb, veiled from birth."
"That was me."
You are here for me."
His eyes opened, and I noticed the red had spread until only a hint of blue remained.
"You will give me dignity."
I nodded. Anyone cursed by a craven's bite did not die in their beds quietly and as peacefully as possible. They were not afforded that kindness or sympathy. Instead, they were generally dragged to the town square to be burned alive in front of a mass of citizens. It didn't matter that most became cursed either protecting those who cheered their horrific demise or working to better the kingdom. Marlowe's gaze shifted to the closed door behind me.
She's a good woman.
She said, "You're a good man." Those eerie eyes tracked back to me.
"I won't be a—"
His upper lip curled, revealing one deadly sharp tooth.
"I won't be a good man much longer."
"No, you won't be."
I tried to do it myself, but
it's okay. Slowly, I pulled the dagger out from under my cloak. The glow of the nearby candle glittered off the deep red blade. Marlowe eyed the dagger.
"Bloodstone."
Before any signs of the curse, a mortal could be killed in any number of ways. But once there were signs, only fire and bloodstone could kill the cursed. Only bloodstone or wood, sharpened into a stake from the blood forest, could kill a fully turned craven.
I just wanted to say goodbye,
he shuddered.
That was all.
I understand, I told him, even though I wished he hadn't returned here. But I didn't have to agree with his actions to understand them. His pain was starting to return, rising in sharp pulses, and then ebbing. Are you ready, Marlowe? His gaze shifted to the closed door once more, and then his eyes closed. He nodded, chest heavy, and unsure if it was my grief or his that weighed me down. I shifted ever so slightly. There were two ways to kill a craven or someone cursed, as long as you had a bloodstone blade or wood from a blood forest tree. Penetrate the heart or destroy the brain. The former wasn't immediate. It could take minutes to bleed out, and it was painful and messy. Placing my left hand against his too cold cheek, I leaned over him.
I wasn't the only one,
he whispered. My heart stopped.
What? Ridley. He was bitten too.
A wheezing breath left him.
He wanted to say goodbye to his father. I don't know if he took care of himself or not.
If this Ridley had waited until the curse began to show signs, there was no way he would have been able to do it. Whatever was in the blood of the Kraven, of an Atlantean, triggered some sort of primal survival instinct.
Gods.
Where does his father live?
2 blocks over. 3rd home. Blue. I think Blue Shutters. But Ridley, he lives in the dorms with the others.
Good gods, this could be bad. You've done the right thing, I told him, wishing he'd done it sooner.
Thank you.
Marlowe grimaced, and his eyes opened once more. There was no more blue. He was close. Seconds. I struck, as fast as the black vipers that hid in the valleys that led to the temples. The tip of the dagger sank into the soft spot at the base of his skull, angled frontward and between the vertebrae, the blade piercing deep, severing the brainstem. Marlowe jerked. That was all. He'd taken his last breath before he even knew it. Death was as instantaneous as it could be. I eased the blade out as I rose from the bed. Marlowe's eyes were closed. That was one small blessing. Agnes could not see how close he'd come to turning into a nightmare.
May rain escort you to paradise,
I whispered, wiping the blood from my dagger on a small towel that had been draped over the end table. And may you find eternal peace with those who have passed before you. Turning from the bed, I sheathed the dagger and then replaced my mask and lifted my hood, tugging it over my head. Ridley. I started for the door. If Ridley were still alive, he had to be within minutes of turning. It was nighttime, and if he was in that dorm where others who were off duty slept, I shuddered. No matter how well-trained they were as vulnerable as anyone else while asleep. Concern for a certain guard from the rise surfaced, and fear pierced my chest and stomach. A massacre could be minutes away from happening. Worse yet, the curse would spread. And I, more than anyone, knew how quickly it could ravage a city until nothing but blood pooled in the streets. Chapter 5. We left Agnes in the bedroom, her husband's limp hand pressed to her chest, as she carefully brushed his hair back from his face. It was an image I wouldn't forget for a very long time. But I couldn't dwell on it then. I'd learned from Victor that there was a daughter, but luckily she was staying with friends, having been told that her father was ill. Victor saw no reason not to believe Agnes. I was relieved to know that my worst fear hadn't come true, that the child hadn't also been cursed. Once someone had been cursed, a bite from them would pass on the curse, and even though Marlowe hadn't fully turned, he would have been prone to uncontrollable rages and thirst from the moment he'd been bitten. But now, I stood outside another tiny home, in the shadows of the narrow, dirt-packed alley, listening to another tragedy. The moment I'd shared with Victor what Marlowe had told me, we'd gone straight for the father's house, since it was closer than the dorms. I was beyond